Yeah, that was a joke. I think you knew that. But we are going to be covering about 400 years here in the next few minutes. So that's going to be interesting. We're going through the histories of the city of God, called Jerusalem. It's a physical city, then it's a spiritual city when we reach most of the New Testament. And so we just call it the city of God, and it has an incredibly rich history of which you and I are greatly a part of to this day. What's interesting is you have this Old Testament, and then you have this New Testament, all of which record great details about the city of God and the people of God. But there is roughly 400 years in between the Testaments. And last installment of this study, we had considered the return of God's people from Babylonian captivity. That's when you run into individuals like Ezra and Nehemiah and Zechariah and Haggai and Malachi. And that those folks kind of finish up what we call the Old Testament, and then there's no other prophet, it seems, until John the Baptist beginning in the Gospel accounts, and then shortly after him comes the Lord, and then the church, and all those things that we know all too well about. So between the days of Malachi and Zechariah and Haggai to Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John is roughly 400 years. And people call this time frame the 400 years of silence. Have you ever heard that term? You probably have. The 400 years of silence. And it can be a misleading concept. I use the term myself. It's not that it's false, but it can be misleading. So what I want to talk to you about this evening is the history. Follow that history of the city of God through that portion of time that is often called the 400 years of silence. But the point that I want to make to you right off the bat and continue to make it throughout the entirety of this lesson is that God is by no means silent about the 400 years of silence. See, the 400 years of silence it refers to the idea that God was silent for 400 years, that there was no prophet. And that's true, but let's not fall into the idea that just because God did not have a prophet that we know of on the earth between Malachi to Matthew, from Malachi to Matthew, from the Old Testament to the New Testament, to say that there was no prophet, but let's not make the mistake of thinking that God was silent about that time period, because he wasn't. In fact, God speaks in a great deal of detail about that period of time, mostly as it surrounds the city of God. And he does that mainly through the book of Daniel. And there's a lot to this, but we're going to be looking at Daniel chapter 11 to fulfill our purposes tonight. But friends, we could look at the 400 years of silence. God talks about the 400 years of silence and gives details about it in Daniel chapter 2, Daniel chapter 7, Daniel chapter 8, 9, 10, and 11. And chapter 12, he deals with basically just the first century. Daniel is really filled with information, various information about this time period of which often called the 400 years of silence. Daniel is kind of on that, the bicuspid of this period that would soon become, and he has great concerns about the people of God. He has great concerns about the city of Jerusalem, and he's praying about these things, and an angel comes to him and just talks to him about this time period. So we have information all throughout the book of Daniel, but here in Daniel 11 is the most systematic approach to it. It's kind of an orderly account of the what we call the 400 years of silence, and we're going to kind of go through some of these things, mostly focusing on what pertains to the city of God. Daniel 11 in verse 1, Daniel says, "Also in the first year of Darius the Mede, I stood up to confirm and strengthen him, and now I will tell you the truth. Behold, three more kings will arise in Persia, and the fourth shall be far richer than them all. By his strength, through his riches, he shall stir up all against the realm of Greece." And so here he begins with this historical account, although it's not history yet. It hasn't even happened yet. But he is beginning to outline what's going to start in this 400 years of silence, in which God, in this chapter, is talking in great detail about. So, again, he is not silent about the 400 years. He is silent during the 400 years. So what is said here in verse 2 is that after Darius, of which Daniel is contemporary with, Darius the Mede, the ruler of the Medes and the Persians, after him will come three more kings, of which I put up here on the board. We're going to be using the PowerPoint quite a bit tonight. Ahasuerus and Artaxerxes and another Darius will come. And so there will be three kings, just as it is established here for Persia here in verse 2. And then there will be a fourth after those three that will be distinct from the previous. He will be greater than all, richer than all, and he will stir up all against the realm of Greece. Now this feller's name is Xerxes, and he will be the fourth to come, and he will be the Persian king. And you can look up in your secular history books, and you'll see this individual. In fact, there have been movies made, you know, about the Greeks and the war between the Persians and the Greeks. And Hollywood has set their mind on that time period in several different movies, I think. But Artaxerxes, he has an army of over 5 million individuals. Okay, you know, and to put that in perspective, the United States of America has about 1.2, 1.3 million, not counting any kind of reserve, but so about 1.2 million, 1.3, while Xerxes has 5 million. So this is an enormous army, and he has set against Greece. And that's what is being dealt with here at the end of verse 2, that there will be an individual richer than all, with great strength, with great riches. He will stir up the realm against Greece. And now after Xerxes, it says in verse 3 that a mighty king shall arise who shall rule with great dominion and do according to his will. And when he has arisen, his kingdom shall be broken up and divided toward the four winds of heaven, but not among the posterity, nor according to his dominion with which he ruled. For his kingdom shall be uprooted even for others besides these. And what this can fit none other than the mighty king that would come from Greece, and his name was Alexander. He's often called Alexander the Great. Here, according to Daniel 11, verse 3, he was a mighty king arising, and he'd rule with great dominion, and he would do according to his will. But in verse 4, it says that when he has arisen, all right, so when he has obtained great dominion, and he's done basically whatever he wanted to do, once he has arisen to that point, all of a sudden his kingdom is divided up. And again, taking a look at the secular history, you see with Alexander the Great, you know, he made great conquests, conquering the world for the most part. But then at the age of 32, once he's arisen, Once he's had that great dominion, he dies. And there's various theories as to why he dies, but the reality is we don't know why he died. We see God speaking about this time in which this great king would arise and conquer the world, essentially. But once he's reached that point, his kingdom will be broken up, in verse 4, towards the four winds of heaven. And Alexander's kingdom, the Grecian kingdom, or the Macedonian Empire, as it could also be called, was divided primarily into four different places, areas, and regions among four of his generals. If you notice there in verse 4, it says that his kingdom would not be divided among his posterity, nor according to his dominion. The idea is it would not be given to an heir, his own posterity. And that's exactly what happens with Alexander. When he dies, his kingdom is divided up mostly into fourths to his four top generals, Lysimachus, Antipater, Seleucus the First, and Ptolemy the First. These are his four great generals, and they obtain fourths of the Macedonian Empire. And what happens when you divide a people or an empire? Well, it's not great. And that's the situation, that as great as the Macedonian Empire was under Alexander the Great, it becomes not great at all once he is dead. The empire is given to mostly these four individuals, but there are others as well. The end of verse 4 makes light of that, that there will be others, smaller portions of land that were given, granted to others when Alexander died. Now, what's going to happen is we're going to be following, because Daniel 11 is going to be following these latter two, Seleucus and Ptolemy. Seleucus the First, his region of which he will rule, become king over, will be the Seleucus Empire, and Ptolemy will be the Ptolemaic Empire or kingdom. And if you look where these kingdoms fall in terms of the map, geographically, when you're looking at Jerusalem, this small land of Judah, you have the Ptolemaic Empire, which was just south of Jerusalem there in Africa, just across the way. And just north of Jerusalem, you had the Seleucid Empire. And so you have a divided Macedonian Empire, and right smack dab in the middle of the Seleucid Empire and Ptolemaic Empire is Jerusalem. Now, you see that both of these empires lasted over 200 years. Okay, that's as long as the United States of America has been around. So they lasted for a good while. And just looking at this geographically and logically, you have a division of empires here, and Jerusalem's in the middle. That's probably not going to be a very good situation. And it wasn't. These empires fought against each other, and many, many times they did. And poor Judah is right in the middle of this. It's just not a good situation. So, let's continue on here. I said we were going to continue on. Looks like the computer is frozen up some. There we go. Is it up now? There we go. All right. So as it goes on, you can read through. This is a long chapter. We're not going to go through it all. We're mostly picking out the portions that deal with the city of God, Jerusalem. And so the text is going to continue with a discussion of the king of the south. And the king of the north. I'm not going to go back because the PowerPoint might go crazy on me again. But the king of the south, the king of the north, that's what we just saw. The Seleucid was the king of the north. And the Ptolemaic Empire is the king of the south. And so Daniel's going to use that kind of terminology and how they're going to war against each other all the time for many, many years. And verse 20, it's going to show that that Jerusalem's going to unfortunately get involved with this. And in Daniel 11, verse 20, it says, "There shall arise in his place," and is another king that's going to come from this empire, the Seleucid Empire, would be one who imposes taxes on the glorious kingdom. All right, so you have a north king, you have a south king, and in the middle you have what Daniel refers to as the glorious kingdom. We can guess what that is, all right? That's God's glory, that's God's people, and God's city. But within a few days, he would be destroyed. So a new king comes up of the Seleucid Empire, but in a few days he would be destroyed. It says, but he won't be destroyed out of anger or from battle. So he's slain, but not because someone was mad at him, and not because it was an accident of battle or anything like that, a casualty of war. And what he's referring to is this next king that arise, which would be Seleucus the Fourth. And he, in fact, was, once he became king, he was quickly slain. Not because anybody was mad at him, they just thought it'd be politically best at the time to do so. So, you know, poor guy, but that was the situation. It was an expedient for the nation to slay him. So he was slain, and what rises in his place, notice verse 21, and in his place shall arise a vile person, to whom they will not give the honor of royalty, but he shall come in peaceably and seize the kingdom by intrigue. All right, so this is a man who, from the text, he's obviously not going to come from the lineage of the kings. He doesn't have royalty in his blood, but by intrigue, he just happens to be there. All right, intrigue, or the King James says flattery. And what happens once Seleucus the Fourth is slain is you have a man arising by the name of Antiochus the Fourth Epiphanes. And Epiphanes isn't his name, that's really just a title or nickname for him, which I think he's given himself. Epiphanes means God manifest, all right? So he thinks he's God. And so, and this certainly follows suit with what it was said back in verse 21, in his place shall arise a vile person. No royalty in his blood either. He comes in peaceably and by flattery, by intrigue, all of a sudden he's made the king of the Seleucid Empire. And so this is the situation of Antiochus. He worked his way in, and he was a likable fellow by the idea of the other kings around, and through those kinds of influences, he is able to become king. Now, in verse... the text is going to continue here. If we see in verse 22, it says, "With the force of a flood, they shall be swept away from before him and be broken, and also the prince of the covenant." The prince of the covenant. Now, again, thinking of Daniel's language and how he talks, he's talking about the glorious city. He's talking about the king of the north here. This vile person, and he's talking about a prince of the covenant. Now, I would suggest, and this falls in suit with history, I would suggest that the prince of the covenant that he's referring to would be the high priest of the glorious city, and being the prince of the covenant, which when Antiochus became king, he removed Onias, which was the high priest at the time in Jerusalem. He removed Onias and later assassinated Onias. And Antiochus put his own priest in the temple of God in Jerusalem. And there's a lot more that he did terribly to the city of Jerusalem. If we continue on, it talks about the terrible, vile reign of Antiochus. If you skip down to verse 28, it says, "While returning to his land with great riches, his heart," this is Antiochus, "his heart shall be moved against the holy covenant, so he shall do damage and return to his own land." His heart is set on the south, Africa. All right, the Ptolemaic Empire. And he's up there in the north, the Seleucid Empire. He wants to obtain the south. And so he's on that. His goal is not so much on Jerusalem and Judah. He doesn't care about that so much. He wants that south. He wants Africa. But he can't get it. And so he's a bully. And so what does he do? He's not getting what he wants, so he's just beating up on Jerusalem. He's beating up on Judah. Now, in verse 30, it says that ships from Cyprus shall come up against him. Therefore, he shall be grieved and return in rage against the holy covenant and do damage. So he shall return and show regard for those who forsake the holy covenant. So it gets to a point in which he is being defeated by the Ptolemaic Empire. And he is grieved, according to the text. He's grieved, he's humiliated, he's angry. So what does he do? He's going to focus on something that he can defeat. Judah. He can't beat the south, and he's angry about that. But he can beat Judah. And that's what he does. And he attacks Jerusalem. 40,000 die. 40,000 also are taken into captivity. Antiochus takes over Jerusalem and Judah and the temple. We've already known that he's put his own priest in the temple. Antiochus also says that the law of Moses is against the law. You are not allowed anymore to follow the law of Moses. In fact, he tries to burn all the copies of the law of Moses. He also outlaws circumcision. If one was caught circumcising their child, the child would be put to death and the parents would be put to death. No more sacrifices by the people. Of course, no observances of the Sabbath, because, again, this is all part of the law of Moses. Another thing he did was he set up an idol of Zeus in the temple of God in Jerusalem. So this is one of the darkest times of the city of Jerusalem, for sure. And let's see where we left off here. In verse 32... we didn't finish that. Verse 31 says, "And forces shall be mustered by him, and they shall defile the sanctuary fortress. Then they shall take away the daily sacrifices and place there the abomination of desolation." That's what we're talking about. He takes away the daily sacrifices, and he places the abomination of desolation in the temple. Otherwise, seems to suggest the reference to him putting up Zeus as an idol in the temple. Now in verse 32, it says, "Those who do wickedly against the covenant, he shall corrupt with flattery. But the people who know their God shall be strong and carry out great exploits." So, a conflict arises. There are people who are in Jerusalem and Judah, and they're wicked people. We've always seen that in the physical land of Judah. It was always that way. There was always the vile folk, the wicked folk, that wouldn't obey the commandment of God anyway. So it doesn't matter. So they're on the side of Antiochus here. But then you had others that were loyal and faithful to the law of Moses and to God. And this is a great conflict here that is going on. And it says at the end of verse 32 that the people who know their God shall be strong and carry out great exploits. So, this is what happens. There's a man named Mattathias. And he's just a regular guy, for the most part. But he was loyal to the law of Moses, and he hates all these things happening. Well, what happens is Antiochus has set up his own priest in the temple. Well, this man, Mattathias, sees this priest sacrificing a swine on the altar. And everything about the picture was against the law of Moses, of course. But this man just becomes overwhelmed over the sight of this. And he can't stand it. And he attacks the guy, this priest that Antiochus put in place. He attacks him and he kills him. And then what happens? Well, he runs away. You know, reminds me kind of what happened to Moses in Egypt. And so he runs away, he grabs his family, and he goes, runs off into the wilderness. Now, what he did not expect to happen is that all these other folks that were desired to continue to serve God instead of Antiochus start to surface. And they saw what he did, and they run out after him. And so out in the wilderness now is this great multitude of individuals, and they're all on the same side. They're against Antiochus and what he's done, and so they form this little group there in the wilderness, and they turn around, and they go back into Judah, and they become their own little army, and, guerrilla warfare and all sorts of other stuff, but... So this army led by this Mattathias who would soon die, they fight against these wicked individuals in Judah and Antiochus and they win Judah back. They win Judah back, and this is what the text is dealing with here. Verse 33 it says, and those of the people who understand. Okay, those, the people of the law of God, those who understand will instruct many, yet for many days they shall fall by the sword and flame, by captivity and plundering. Now when they fall, they shall be aided with a little help, but many shall join with them by intrigue, and some of those of understanding shall fall, to refine them and purify them, to make them white until the time of the end, because it is still for an appointed time. So their goal was to purify. Their goal was to make Judah and Jerusalem pure and white again. And they essentially accomplished that by their, as Daniel calls it, their great exploits. And he says, and they get many by intrigue. And so there are people that are not so much in line with exactly the viewpoints of Mattathias and his family, but they join up for them for whatever reason, just, you know, politically or whatever it might be. Now, Mattathias, his son, is named Judas, and he has a nickname, Maccabeus, which that might ring a bell to you. You think, well, the Maccabees. Well, that's the time period that we're dealing with, the Maccabees. And there are four books of the Maccabees. Two of them are in the Catholic Bible. They ought not be there because they're not inspired by God. They're kind of fun to read, though, if you ever have the time. And they're kind of just history books with, I think, a few fables and tales therein. Well, we lost the PowerPoint, so that's all right. On a night that you all really needed the PowerPoint, we lost it. That's okay, because we're almost done, so that's okay. But, so the situation here is this man, Judas, his nickname is Maccabeus, which that means the hammer, all right? So you can kind of get an idea of the kind of personality that this guy has. His nickname is the hammer. And the Maccabees, so to speak, are these individuals that that have reconquered the land of Judah, and they purify it. And so they slay these individuals, they get rid of these individuals, they purify the temple, and I think it's probably just a fable, but I'll just say it real quick. They purify the temple, and all they found in the temple that was not touched yet by the Seleucids was this little bottle of lamp oil. And it was only enough lamp oil to last one night. All right. And so as the fable goes, according to the account of the Maccabees, is they filled the lampstand in the temple, you know, otherwise known as the menorah. And they filled the lampstand with that oil. And that oil that was supposed to last one day actually lasted 7 days. All right. Is any of this ringing a bell? Hanukkah? Okay. That's where that comes from. All right. It was a tale. I highly doubt it was true, but whatever the case was, that was a tale that they told. And that all came from this time period here in this 400 years of silence that God's by no means silent about. He's describing in good detail exactly what is going to be happening. Now, one thing for us that's so critical for us to know about this time period is Judas Maccabeus, his followers would become known one day as the Sadducees. And that's critical for our understanding of the New Testament text. This is the origin of the Sadducees. Now, there were other people that did not follow Judas Maccabeus, but they, by intrigue, for whatever reason, they were with him. And these are the folks that later became known as the Pharisees, which, by the way, the term Pharisee means separatists. These are folks that have separated themselves and made themselves pure, and that's why they call themselves the Pharisees. So the Pharisees and Sadducees both came out of this situation of the Maccabean revolt against the Seleucid Empire, and they retook Judah, and it became known as the Hasmonean Kingdom. Hasmonean comes from the name of Mattathias' great-grandfather. All right, so it's named after Judas Maccabeus' great-great-grandfather. So that's why they named it the Hasmonean Kingdom. But it's still Judah, and they purify as best that they could the land and the temple and the law. Now, the latter portion here that we're not going to really be dealing with here, the latter portion of chapter 11, beginning verse 36 and onward, is going to deal with a new sheriff in town, so to speak, Rome, and the dealings with Rome in the world, and the dealings with Rome a little bit with the land of Judah. If you notice there in verse 41, it says, "He being the king, he also shall enter the glorious land, and many countries shall be overthrown, but these shall escape his hand, Edom, Moab, and the prominent people of Ammon." So Judah is going to be caught up in the mix once again. They had their own kingdom. They were independent after the Seleucid Empire, and now, once again, they're retaken by Rome. And that happens in, I don't have the PowerPoint on me, I think that's about 63 B.C. or 66 B.C. They are taken. And they become a Roman kingdom. And their name is no longer Judah. It's changed to Judea. And that's the situation. Pretty much leads us there to the first century, which we'll have to be dealing with at another time. So that latter portion seems to be dealing with the ending of the Ptolemaic Empire. The last leader, ruler of the Ptolemaic Empire, most everyone knows, is Cleopatra. and her exploits with Mark Antony and that situation, and then Julius Caesar and General Pompey, individuals like that. That seems to be the bulk of what the latter portion of chapter 11 is dealing with. Then you get into Daniel chapter 12, and he's talking about the first century situation and the destruction of Jerusalem and many good things that, if the Lord wills, we're going to be dealing with once we get to all of that. What is the takeaway here? Well, we talked about a portion of Scripture that's kind of hard to talk about, Daniel 11. We don't usually go over Daniel 11. So it was a good opportunity for us to do that. But also the takeaway, these 400 years of silence, God has been so detailed about it. He was not silent about it. Though he did not have a prophet through that time period, he spoke to prophets prior to that time with great detail about exactly what would take place all the way through and up to the destruction of Jerusalem in the first century, which Daniel closes with in Daniel chapter 12. I appreciate your attention this evening. And Brother Roy, what was that invitation song? We're not going to have the PowerPoint. 294 is going to be the invitation song, number 294. And we offer the gospel's invitation to anyone here who is yet to establish fellowship with Jesus Christ, that if you would come unto him in repentance of your sins, to be baptized for the remission of your sins.